back in 2001, and is sitting out at L2, a quiet spot beyond the moon, where it observes the microwave sky over the whole sky. We're a small team. It was originally based from NASA Goddard and Princeton, with a few other American institutions too, although we've now dispersed somewhat. And Chuck Bennett, our PI, has gone to Johns Hopkins with a group of people there. And Gary Hinshaw remains at Goddard, being our data analysis lead, keeping us in check week by week. So I'm going to be talking about our five-year results. We've recently been approved by NASA for 9 years of operations. So this, what I tell you here is not the end of the story from the experiment. I also want to acknowledge that those people noted here who are no longer on the team, but all the stuff that we present and our results come from years of work by all the people involved in the collaboration. So it's certainly not an individual effort. So just a reminder of the work we've done was an analysis of 5 years of data running through from, and the papers we put out, seven papers, ran through from basic results, through a look at the observations, the beams of the telescope, a couple of papers on contamination from the galaxy, from point sources beyond our galaxy, and then cosmological papers on the CMB power spectrum, on parameters, and on interpretation. So I'm thinking for this audience that Achiro's paper is probably the one that people have already referred to or would refer to. But if you actually want to know about the experiment at all, then Gary's paper is a good summary of the actual telescope. And the actual data we get from it. Okay, so just to put us into context, we're looking, this is a little schematic of the early universe. Its density as a function of decreasing redshift or increasing time. So we started off with this hot, dense universe dominated by radiation. As it cooled and expanded, it started to become, instead, dominated by matter, but the universe was still ionized. And then at this point in time, after about a few hundred thousand years, the universe cooled enough such that atoms formed, photons no longer scattered off electrons in the atoms and passed freely through us today. And this surface between the ionized and neutral universe is the surface of last scattering where we like to look at the cosmic microwave background light. And then much later we get, you know, stars forming after maybe 100 million years. And much later on still, after about a billion years, we have galaxies and quasars, and later on still, dark energy will perhaps start to dominate in our universe. So the reason we like to look at this surface is it was all very nice and simple then. Things were linear. We really understand it, and as a cosmological probe, that's why the CMB continues to give us key cosmological parameters, data, and results. We really think we know what's going on. We have some mechanism, be it inflation or another mechanism, that seeded fluctuations in the early universe. They'll then enter into the horizon and evolve gravitationally. And so you'll have a cold dark matter element, which will cluster gravitationally, and you'll have the photon baryon fluid, which will set up oscillations. You'll have photon baryon oscillations continuing until the universe becomes neutral, and we get a snapshot of the universe at that point. And so the predictions we can make of what we should see at that point are really remarkably accurate. We have numerical codes that agree to better than 0.1% of what we should expect to see back at that time. And so what we actually do is go and measure the temperature fluctuations of the CMB over the whole sky. We measure that temperature pixel by pixel, and then we go and decompose it into spherical harmonics. And from those spherical harmonics, we take the coefficients and construct a power spectrum from those coefficients. And if those fluctuations are Gaussian, then primordial fluctuations, then that's all we need to specify the properties of the universe at that point. So we go and measure this with WMAP, we compute this, and then we use our numerical codes to predict what we should expect, and we compare the two, and that's how we get cosmological parameters out, by matching them up, basically. And we don't only measure the temperature over the sky, we also measure its polarization, the polarization of our microwave light. And so what do we see? We've seen pictures that seem probably familiar to you all. By observing for 5 years, we don't look at anything different. We just look at every point in the sky for longer, and we get higher signal to noise at every point on our sky. And so we observe at 5 different frequencies, between 20 and 90 gigahertz, so that's millimeter wavelength. And we do that because there's a huge great galaxy that we're sitting in and we have to look through, and it's also emitting microwaves, and so we have to, you know, see beyond it. And so these just show the all sky maps of the microwave sky, with this range being minus 200 to 200 microkelvin, from 20, 30, 40, 60, and 90 gigahertz. And up here, we have a lot of emission from the galaxy because you have synchrotron radiation from relativistic electrons in our magnetic field emitting radiation. Luckily, that decreases as we go up in frequency, as does emission from free emission and from little spinning dust grains as well that could be in there sending out light. We have a sweet spot around 40 to 60 gigahertz where we have the lowest amount of contamination from this galaxy, from our galaxy. And then up at higher frequencies, you get emission from dust grains in our galaxy sending out light. So we always have to be really careful that we remove this light, and we combine those signals together well enough to get the cosmology out. Then we also go measure the polarization. So we expect the CMB to be polarized for a few reasons. The first is simply that velocity perturbations at the surface of our scatter will seed polarization, but also if we have any gravitational waves around too, they will also seed polarization, but with handedness, so we get the B mode of polarization. We would get that if we have gravitational waves. And then you again get polarization when the universe reionizes at a much later time, so you get the different signals. And so commonly, theoretically, we have these E modes and B modes that we'll predict theoretically, but we don't observe that. We observe Stokes parameters. We observe Q and U Stokes parameters on the sky. So the Q Stokes parameter is in this direction of polarization, and the U Stokes parameter is this direction of polarization. And we can construct polarization amplitude maps in the same way as temperature, in the same frequencies, going up in frequency from low to large. And the tricky thing here is that the galaxy is still polarized, but the CMB polarization signal is 2 orders of magnitude down from the temperature signal. 2 orders of magnitude smaller, but the polarization signal is not 2 orders of magnitude smaller from the galaxy. So that's why we see this huge great galactic signal up at these low frequencies, and that's from synchrotron emission. Again, conveniently, as we go to these middle frequencies, the emission is lowest. But it really has been, it's something that we spend a lot of time worrying about. But the thing that we've been working on a lot these last couple of years is really making sure of our ability to remove the signal from the galaxy. And so when we analyzed 3 years of data, we only were confident in using these two maps where the signal is lowest from our galaxy. But this time we've gone back and added in this one as well because we're sure that we've cleaned out the light from our own galaxy. And this gives us a whole extra map to work with to use for cosmology that we didn't use before, as well as extra observing time. And so that benefits us more than just sitting observing the sky for longer. So we use extra data this time around. The other improvements we make, which might not seem crucial, but actually it's pretty important, is improving our model of the beam, which says, if I look at a point in the sky with my telescope, what am I really seeing? I don't just see a single point in the sky, it's spread out a bit. And we've spent a lot of time modeling that better to determine what we see on the sky. And that matters, for example, because it influences what we then measure in terms of the power spectrum of primordial fluctuations. Which is a number many people want to know. So that matters too. So we have had analysis improvements and we've just simply collected more data. Okay, so what do we measure? So we take those maps and we construct the angular power spectrum from the maps. And so, again, a familiar sight is the angular power spectrum where we range from large scales to small scales along here with multipole L increasing. And you see the familiar power spectrum with acoustic oscillations at these smaller scales. And this is the power in the CMB. And where we've really done better with longer observation time is to get this third acoustic peak. So this is the red curve is the prediction of our simple lambda CDM cosmological model. And until, you know, just with our newest data, it predicted this region of space, but we weren't seeing that. It was very noisy. And so we only really had that first peak and the second peak and some indication of that third peak. And knowing that position and height is going to tell us important improvements about cosmological parameters. So that's a good thing. This down here is the correlation between the temperature on the sky and the E-mode of the polarization. And we expect to see this anti-correlated and correlated signal because they're both tracing the same thing, essentially. One's tracing the density and one's tracing the velocity at of perturbations at recombination. And once again, we've pushed out to higher multipole, smaller angular scale, and we've seen this before, this anti-correlation that's really a strong prediction of the lambda CDM model. But seeing these higher correlations really goes towards confirming or validating our simple model. So the second, yeah, okay. So the first big improvement is that. the second thing is in the polarization. As I said, we've measured for longer, and we're adding in a whole extra map to our observations. And so where we're doing well is in the E mode of polarization. So this is now just a zoom in on the. So this is now again that's actually the square root of the power spectrum of the CMB. So to see it more clearly. See the amplitude clearly. Sorry. But up here is the temperature, and down here in green is the lambda CDM model for the E-mode polarization. And zooming in on that red box over here, where I'm now plotting power, this is the signal we expect to see from reionization of the universe, the larger scales in the E-mode polarization. That's when the universe ionizes, the CMB quadrupole should scatter off this ionized electrons and create this polarization signal. And we're seeing it at these very larger scales. So these are multipoles out to 7. So this is this part. And what we're seeing, and here are the data points, is a positive detection. And it works out to be a 5 sigma detection of essentially the ionization of the universe. We quantify that in terms of the optical depth, which tells us the integrated number of electrons to the time at which the universe reionized. And when we quantify that, then with previous data, with our 3-year data, then we had a handle on what the optical depth was, about 0.09, but it was 3 sigma different from 0, and that was how well we detected polarization. But now we've halved that with the same central value, but half the limits from this extra polarization data. And now, even if you don't care about reionization, which you might do, but this could tell us a lot about the primordial fluctuations too. So that learning about polarization isn't just helping us learn about reionization. Okay, so let's take a look at our favorite currently, perhaps, cosmological model, lambda CDM, and some of the numbers that we're getting out of the data. So as a reminder, this is a flat universe. It's described by just 6 parameters. It's filled with baryons, cold dark matter, a cosmological constant, neutrinos and photons. And the perturbations in it are Gaussian, they're adiabatic, nearly scale invariant, as we might expect from inflation, for example. So up here, I'm showing distributions for 4 of those parameters describing the model. And these show 68% and 95% confidence levels, essentially 1 and 2 sigma levels for these parameters. Up here is the dark matter density, the cold dark matter density, the relic density left over. And this would be correspond to whatever dark matter candidate we should have. And this is sigma 8, the amplitude of fluctuations on 8 megaparsec scales in the universe. And so in the gray, we had our previous results. And in the blue, we have our current best estimates. And so we've shrunk that space of possible parameters, mostly by that improvement in the third peak of the temperature spectrum, although slightly in terms of the polarization has improved the estimate of the amplitude, actually. And it's a little bit higher than before. Sigma 8 is about 0.8. And that pleases a lot of people as well, because it's more consistent with many other astronomical observations. It's still perfectly consistent with our previous value around there, but it's pointing towards something consistent with, for example, weak lensing measurements. Over here, this is the spectral index of primordial fluctuations. This is power law fluctuations imprinted by whatever mechanism we think in the early universe, and where 1 corresponds to scale invariant fluctuations, and then obviously less than 1 is generically predicted by simple inflation models. So we'd like to know if that number really is less than 1 or not. And then this is the optical depth I was talking about before. And previously, with the first observations of WMAP, there was this huge degeneracy up here. We really couldn't tell very well the spectral index. But nailing down the polarization better helped us somewhat with 3 years in the gray curves. But now we've shrunk down this space into the blue curves, where the two are almost uncorrelated now. We've really separated out those two signals. But tantalizingly, with 3 years, the spectral index was 2.5 sigma from 1. If you wanted to rule out a spectral index of 1 and really go for an inflation model, then it was still only 2.5 sigma, and it's still 2.5 sigma sitting there hovering. So we need to observe for longer. We need to have Planck go up. We need to have other experiments be measuring this to really know whether this is really going to be different from 1 or whether it's actually consistent with scale invariant. An interesting thing that comes out of this, too, is that if you look at when the universe reionized from converting that optical depth to looking at the reionization epoch, we normally assume the universe reionized straight away, almost instantaneously. It went from being neutral to being completely ionized. And if you assume that, then the reionization redshift we get out is 11 plus or minus 1.5. And this is interesting because it rules out a redshift of 6 at more than 3 sigma. And that would be about a billion years after the Big Bang. But other observations tell us that the universe was still partially ionized at that point from looking at quasars. So this is perhaps the first hint that the universe, or a good hint that the universe would have ionized more gradually, because we see too much polarization for the universe to have just ionized all at once at redshift of 6. So again, future observations of the polarization of the CMB will help us to kind of distinguish between different histories. But it's a nice little look at that. Okay, so this model is incredibly consistent with almost any observations you can throw at it. It's really hard to come up with something that doesn't agree. Up here, I'm just zooming in on the even smaller scales of the CMB, where in the blue data points, this is results from the Akbar experiment, looking at really high resolution. Again, this is the power spectrum, and this is the prediction in red of the lambda CDM model. And our data goes out to about here, but if we extend the model just from fitting our own data, it passes right through all the Akbar data points, even though we haven't been observing at that high resolution. So the picture is consistent at the large scales and at the small scales. If we look at, for example, the type 1a supernovae, as a measure of the expansion rate of the universe, or looking at barren acoustic oscillations, where we look at how much the galaxies cluster together and their separations as a function of redshift, we continue to see them agreeing. first of all, you want to check that they all agree, and then you want to choose the ones that you might want to combine with WMAP to get even better constraints on parameters. Looking at a whole host of measurements, we continue to see really good agreement. One of the ones that really sticks out is the lithium abundance. That remains to be resolved as to whether there really is a problem with the lithium abundance predicting the wrong amount of baryons that we see with the CMB, or whether we're modeling the observations. We need to model the stellar evolution better to determine whether we're really seeing a discrepancy in the lithium abundance. So I'm going to show you some more results, but whenever I talk about combining data, we chose to pick just the baryon acoustic oscillations that we see in galaxies from Sloan and 2DF and supernovae to place combined constraints on parameters. It's a rather simple combination of data where we're just looking at distance measures to certain astronomical objects plus WMAP to get combined constraints on things. So whenever we sort of talk about combining everything together, we're not combining all these things. We're just combining a couple of extra observations to help out WMAP. So some of the things we'd like to think about is testing inflation. We really like to know whether inflation happens. And the data is certainly consistent with all of these predictions, that the universe is flat, that fluctuations are adiabatic, that they're Gaussian, and then nearly scale invariants. I'll take a look at a couple of these. But one important reminder is that WMAP alone does not say anything about, well, it says very little about the curvature of the universe. This is just a reminder showing the curvature of the universe quantified by omega k and the dark energy density, omega lambda, along here. And if you just use our data, then there's this long degeneracy between the curvature and dark energy where no dark energy and a curved universe is fine. But it has a Hubble constant of around 30 and is inconsistent with other data. So it's only when you add in these extra pieces of data that you then quickly zoom in on this tiny little area where the curvature is constrained to be 0 to within 2%. So that it's dramatic what you can do when you combine them together. And any single piece of data, actually just the baryon, just the galaxy clustering statistic, the baryon acoustic oscillations in the galaxies, actually brings you down to that small volume. You're not combining loads of things together. You're just combining one measure with WMAP to get that. Okay, so something that people here might care about is the non-Gaussianity. Many simple inflation models would say we should have no non-Gaussianity on the sky. And obviously the simplest way to go measure it is to plot the one-dimensional distribution of the temperature fluctuations and say, is it a Gaussian? But it is pretty much a Gaussian if you look at it that way. And so we need better statistics to pull out any signature of non-Gaussianity out of the maps. And so a common way of doing that that matches up very well with what models could predict is to look at the bispectrum. Again, this is now commonly talked about, I think raising a lot of excitement recently, and that's the FNL parameter. So we're looking at the bispectrum of fluctuations. Phi of k is the transform of the curvature perturbations, and we construct a bispectrum from those curvature perturbations, a three-point function. And purely Gaussian fluctuations should have a zero three-point function. So if we can see any three-point function, then we're seeing a sign of non-Gaussianity. And so FNL is a great statistic to quantify how much of that we're seeing. And you can make predictions from models of how much you should see, and then we can go measure it and say, well, do they match up? So we're looking for zero to be consistent with inflation or standard canonical inflation. What we see from the data is that if we place 95% limits on FNL, then they include zero, running between minus 10 and 110, so an error of about 30 on the FNL parameter. Now, that is somewhat dependent on how much of the sky you use. I talked about the galaxy getting in the way. We have to mask out that galaxy, remove that bit of the sky that has a galaxy in it to do this test. And so previous analyses with our three-year data, for example, saw a bigger signal of FNL, almost a 3-sigma detection. That was a paper by Yadav and Vandalt. When we go and do various tests on what this signal is, depending on how much of the sky we cut out, then the 2-sigma limit varies between, you know, -9 and about 0. You can get just over 2-sigma, depending on how you analyze the data. But we're certainly not seeing anything that is a significant detection of non-gas entity in our data at the moment. I think this is something that we need more data to resolve. Anything that's hovering on the 2-sigma level, you just need more data. And that's what we're going to be doing with WMAP. With 9 years, we can get the error bar down to 20. So say the central value stays at 50, that would then be a bigger detection. Planck should get an error of about 5. And so this is getting into interesting regime. But right now, again, it's consistent with 0, consistent with being Gaussian to a 0.1% level in the primordial curvature perturbations. Okay, so we also might predict gravitational waves of a certain amplitude in our inflationary models. And so we can place constraints on the ratio of tensor to scalar fluctuations using the data. Now, one thing to note is that in the future, we hope to detect or place really strong constraints on the gravitational waves from the B mode of polarization. But right now, all of our limits come from the temperature spectrum, or almost all of it. If we just use the B mode polarization, we would get upper limits on R, the tensor scalar ratio, of like 20. So anything we're getting now comes from the fact that tensor perturbations contribute to the temperature fluctuations and modify the temperature spectrum. And so using the influence of that on the temperature fluctuations, we get limits with WMAP alone on the tensor scalar ratio of R less than 0.4. And this shows R correlated with the spectral index NS with this 95% confidence level here, again, tantalizingly going straight through 1 and R equals 0. Over here, this is now when we combine WMAP with the extra data. Same plot of NS and R, and those are the same curves on each one, but this time we're just pointing out some different model predictions on here. So this top figure shows chaotic inflation, where the black dots correspond to 5^4 and the white ones to 5². Down here is power law inflation. But up here, people is something that people concentrate on a lot because 5^4 could be a very simple model for inflation and is now beyond the 3-sigma level. It's definitely disfavored by our data. That's one thing to note. Another thing, a couple of things to note, is that we're getting into an interesting regime. Our limits are R less than 0.2, so we're already excluding a bunch of models that could be considered to be simple models up here. And we're getting very close to getting into the regime of, you know, between 0.1 and 0.2, where, again, a number of models lie. So we're getting down to, we're getting into interesting space. Also, we're cutting off now all this space up here that corresponds to blue spectra, an index of greater than 1. And again, our chaotic inflation models don't predict that, but other models could. And the fact that we're disfavoring that space, again, is telling us something about what kind of initial perturbations we can put in and via what mechanism. Okay, so that's telling us a bit about inflationary properties. One thing I want to talk about too is another aspect content of our universe. So I talked about the simple lambda CDM model containing these different densities and constraining baryon densities and cold dark matter densities and total geometry. I'm not going to spend time on dark energy. We place 6 to 7% errors on a constant equation of state of dark energy. you need doubly map to place good constraints on dark energy parameters, but you also have to combine it with other observations to get those constraints out. But the thing I want to just say a little bit about, because people here might be somewhat interested, is neutrinos. Two things about neutrinos. The first is simply that we can, our normal assumptions are that neutrinos have zero mass, but we can always place, we can place constraints on the neutrino mass by adding it in as a parameter and seeing how that varies our power spectrum. And doing that, we get now limits on the total neutrino mass, the sum of the neutrino masses, of 1.3 eV with just our CMB data, and then down to 0.6 eV with these extra, extra astronomical constraints. If you really want to throw every possible astronomical data set at this measurement, you can squeeze down that limit a little further. But there are a number of systematics that you should then be worried about that could affect your results. One nice thing about this limit, and somewhat this limit too, is that even if you add in different parameters to your model, like you allow gravitational waves, you allow a running spectral index, you allow a different dark energy equation of state, this is stable to all of that. The neutrino mass is not correlated with these other parameters. So you shouldn't really be worried that, you know, have we made too many assumptions when we're telling you that, you know, this is the neutrino mass limit from the CMB. Okay, then finally, we're always assuming something. This is our picture of the contents of the universe today, dominated by dark energy. But back at the CMB time, when it was formed, we think that 10% of the universe was made of neutrinos. And that just comes from assuming that there were three neutrino species. Particle physics tells us that, and we always assume it. Whenever we quote parameters, that's what we're assuming. But we can actually use the cosmological data to decide whether that's really true or not, or try and constrain the amount of neutrinos that we see on large scales in the universe. Yes, sure. So all we're doing cosmologically is that I can't tell you, well, there are ways of doing it, but when we're trying to constrain neutrinos, all we're really constraining is relativistic species in our universe. I can tune up and down the amount of relativistic species that don't interact via the electromagnetic force. And I can relate that to the number of neutrinos. I can compute the density of relativistic species I would predict if I have the density of photons in my universe and I have the number of species. And so if I assume they behave like neutrinos, then that tells me how much relativistic density I should add in. I can vary that up and down, and it will affect my CMB power spectrum. And so if I tune that number up and down, if I tune the number of species, then I find a distribution in probability of what that number could be. And you can see that distribution is very broad at the moment. It could be up to 10 and beyond with the CMB alone. But the interesting thing now with our data at the moment is that it's excluding this region down here with no neutrinos at all or no relativistic species in the universe. Converting that into a two-dimensional figure, this is now the number of species and the dark matter density. And you see that there is this correlation between the two, that you can tune them up and down, and you can still see the same microwave sky. And that this region down here does not fit the data. And that comes from having measured that third peak in the temperature beta, its position and its height. And that's telling us that a universe with no neutrinos or no relativistic species in it is no longer compatible with our observations at the almost three sigma level. So this is something that, again, we want to see better with more data. It's not telling us anything new at the moment, but it's really nice to see this consistency with our model. And what will be really great is that we can hope to zoom in on a region around here with future data. So I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so to conclude, we have our Lambda CDM model that we haven't yet managed to break. It's fitting our data very well, and it's fitting all other data sets remarkably well too. We've learned more about the large-scale CMB polarization and the small-scale CMB temperature down to 0.2 degree scales. And that's told us more about the contents of the universe, including neutrinos, about inflation in the early universe, and about the reionization epoch of the universe. And so with another couple of years of observations, then we should learn even more. Thanks.
Any questions?
You quoted the number 0.4 for limit on R.
Yes, yeah. Which comes down to 0.2 if you add in extra data. Yeah, okay. Yes.
Supposing I had the crackpotty idea that for some odd reason, the tensor modes should only be there between L of 2 and L of 10. Mm-hmm. Would you still have a useful limit?
Yes, actually.
Would it be as tight? Well, it couldn't be as tight, but...
No, but, I mean, the CMB, the spectrum... So as I'm saying, right now we're getting our limits from the temperature spectrum. And what it looks... It's a large-scale signal as it is. So it already drops off.
Yeah.
You know, so... But if I just had a signal at L between 2 and 10, I'd be even more influenced by cosmic variance, which makes my errors down at those lower Ls really bad. So yeah, it would be different, and it would be lower, the constraints. We could play some constraints. But
lower means that it would be not as tight.
Not as tight, yes. No. Sorry, yes.
But
yes.
Could you give a rough number? One, three quarters?
No.
Okay, good. Good, thank you. Yeah,
maybe one. Yeah.
So if we look ahead to WMAP 8 or 9, you mentioned how well you'll do on FNL, which sounded good. What about the famous RMS plot?
So we did a bunch of simulations. That's such a nice thing about when we say this is what we'll do with 9 years, we're reasonably sure we will because we understand the experiment. The forecasts were around, with MAP alone, down to between 0.25 and 0.3 for MAP alone, and now we're at 0.43. So that's a good squeeze down, and then if we add in, there'll be then great improvements from supernova, et cetera, in the next few years. So hopefully it'll be even better. But that would be the MAP alone number, roughly. Sorry, between 0.25 and 0.3. So it wouldn't be down as low as we already are in combination with other data. But obviously, well, for a start, it's nice to see it from one experiment alone, but also then we would imagine an even better limit in combination with other data. If we remain at the same central value, then it would be beyond 3 sigma. But it wouldn't be up to 4 sigma. It would be a little beyond 3 sigma. But that, obviously, that depends where the central value stays.
Any other questions?
When you were showing the FNL constraints, mm-hmm. So one thing that jumped to my eye immediately is that how asymmetric are the quotes on the local FNL. Can you comment on how this comes about?
The asymmetric, sorry.
You had it like from minus 9 to...
Yeah, the central value is 50. Yeah, I mean, certainly the central value is not zero at the moment. It's quite a symmetrical distribution.
Ah, okay, so distribution is symmetric.
Yeah, I don't think I have a plot here. I just have more numbers. But yeah, actually, you can see it's symmetric from these numbers because otherwise we'd be quoting something different for significantly different for positive and negative. So if you want to know the central value, it's that last line. So when I quoted those limits, I was quoting.
Okay, you're quoting just. The
I believe this okay. line. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Last question.
I have a question about the supernova chi-square
yes.
combined. I remember that in your paper you combined different supernova data sets. So how can you combine the chi-square?
Sure, actually that's a good question, and so two ways of answering it. One is that we've actually updated our results now. We haven't put them out yet, but there's this new supernova union combination that's a more cohesive combination. So the question is that we're combining data from different supernova observations and surveys, from the legacy survey, from HST, from supernova essence data. And combining those correctly requires doing properly. And the way we did it that I presented here, that we're in our papers at the moment, simply adds the chi-squared from the legacy survey and the HST data, and then marginalizes over each one separately for the absolute magnitude. But we are actually updating our results using the union data set because we realized that that was a better way of doing it. But it changes the results very little. Yeah.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.